Me when? In the presence of who? Oh, okay.
But alas, faith without works is dead. And in the face of all this, it's time for you to tap into community. That means to engage in community relief efforts. Educate yourself on community resources. Be more open to the people who look like you and let go of the individualism that is set up to leave us weak and vulnerable. And while you're at it, shut up about it.
Why?
Because the revolution will not be televised and it won't be on social media either.
So, Elon Musk got hold of the federal budget. And before I get to explaining anything else, I just want to say this is precisely why Brenda from A Scary Movie, a.k.a. Regina Hall, was in that movie theater like that. Talking about, whoa, this some scary shit. Because this is exactly how black people in this country who have peeked behind the veil have been watching this show of a country unfold for centuries. If a damn show was us last election season yelling, don't go in there. Don't open that door. And now look, y'all just had to go investigating strange noises. And now y'all running around like the helpless white lady who never runs fast enough and tripping over air. And now y'all getting got. So on the list of I told you so's, this week we have Elon Musk and his made up Department of General Efficiency getting access to the federal budget through the Department of Treasury. This civilian, who nobody elected, by the way, has had a team of engineers who have already sunk their claws into at least six government agencies' employees' data and government payments, ignoring protocols and superseding the authority of the actual elected officials. Y'all saw what that man did to Twitter and said, let's give him a cabinet position? America, let's move on. And when the same Democrats some of y'all like to call both sides of the same coin tried to hold him accountable in an oversight hearing, they just got yelled at by Republicans on the House floor and mocked for what they call the Musk derangement syndrome. Oh, this shit sounds silly as fuck, I know, but you have to be aware and mindful because even the most supercilious of terms can be used and wielded as another mass propaganda tool. Up next on the list of don't open that door, the people of Gaza have been freed due to Biden's last minute ceasefire before he left office. I just want to make sure it's clear that Trump had nothing to do with that. But instead of being able to go home, Trump intends to permanently displace Palestinians in order for the U.S. to seize control over Gaza and rebuild it. Rebuild it for what? If the Palestinians can't go home. Did I mention Elon Musk also has control over the U.S. Agency for International Development? Moving along. The same exact fork in the road email that was sent to Twitter employees in 2002 offering them a severance package if they didn't like the direction he was taking the platform in was sent to federal employees this past week. Now they said fuck you and sent him some spoons back in a work group chat. Then, after 27 mass shootings already this year, 18-year-olds can now buy guns. I can't make this shit up. Trans women cannot compete in women's sports, and that's on top of a freeze on gender changes to passports that took place last week. There were also protests in at least 16 states against all of these things on Wednesday, and apparently protests against American government across the globe, but we didn't see them on the timeline. Why? Because Mark and Matt are in cahoots with Trump as well. But alas, as I have been saying, all hope is not lost, because the man is not truly all-powerful. A creator put me onto an op-ed article in the New York Times called Don't Believe Him. In the article, Ezra Klein talks about how all Trump is doing is applying Steve Bannon's approach of muzzle velocity, saturating the media with chaos after chaos after chaos, and a bunch of it is either things he actually doesn't have the power to do, evidenced by the load of executive orders he's passing because he could not actually get this stuff passed through Congress as it stands, executive orders that can simply be reversed by the next president, or things that will incur such a level of backlash that he will likely have to buckle under pressure with his stupid ass. For instance, nobody else on earth is calling the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. It's not happening. Target shareholders are now suing them, folks. That birthright citizenship push shot down by a federal judge. He keeps trying to fire officials, and the officials keep saying no. He turned on those tariffs, and China and Canada turned on him. China's now taxing us on oil, coal, and liquefied natural gas. They're also taxing us on agricultural machinery, pickup trucks, and big cars, and imposing export controls on 25 rare metals necessary for many electrical products and military equipment. Now, most of China's measures won't cause them to lose much money or sleep, but Canada, on the other hand, is prepared to lose something to fight against the threat of tyranny brewing beneath their southern border. Canada, too, has threatened to pull crude oil access from the U.S. And while that will greatly impact its own citizens, the Canadian Prime Minister thinks it's worth it to secure the Mexico-Canada agreement that replaced NAFTA in 2020. They are also responding with 25% tariffs on $155 billion worth of American goods starting next week. Not just things you think only manufacturing plants need, but things signature to your everyday life. They talking beer, y'all. Fruit juice, damn it. Vegetables, perfume, clothing, shoes, household appliances, furniture, etc., etc. More than that, they said they will indeed cut the lights off on our asses by pulling energy exports. But more than that, American people are doing something as well. Several plans for forecasts have come out of all corners of community, including a 90-day intensive research campaign voiced by Reverend Al Sharpton, in which civil rights organizations will band together in late April to begin a boycott against two major companies that have dissolved their DEI practices. And if you want to do something about it, besides standing there with your mouth open looking like Scream by Edward Munch, because your gas and your eggs are now guaranteed to be more expensive, you can participate and show up in droves to these midterm elections this year to help flip the House. Regardless, by both and all means, we must aid in the implosion of an already self-destructive ticking time bomb instead of just bracing ourselves for impact.
We had to double up on Lene this week because she broke her finger. So hopefully she'll return next week or the week after. Next up, we have some other segments for you here on Ebony Spectrum. Next up, we have Dr. Rashad Ritchie. And of course, the topic for the week is Kendrick Lamar.
MAGA Meltdown. Kendrick Lamar. Halftime show. Put it up full mass. When I tell you this was beautifully done, MAGA is melting down over Kendrick Lamar's Super Bowl halftime message, not performance. It was a message in performance by the Grammy winners' performance, including appearances by Samuel L. Jackson playing Uncle Sam, Serena Williams crip walking to a song about an ex-boyfriend that was diabolical. Colorado. Oh, man. Colorado Representative Lauren Boebert was quick to complain. Put it up. Tell me I'm not the only one needing subtitles for this. No, ma'am, you're not. You see, you're not enlightened. I'll put it back up, please. You're not enlightened, ma'am. This message was for the enlightened. I'm going to read what other unenlightened individuals who are not open to the reality of their solution. You're looking at your solution during that halftime show. I will break it down for you. Right-wing commentators, Eric Daughtry, Benny Johnson, took their criticisms to the extreme, describing the performance as black nationalist. Black nationalist. And calling Lamar a, quote, mumbling pagan satanic cultist. Mumbling pagan satanic cultist. Okay. Guys, to the extreme conservatives who have decided to chime in on the polarization of evil in reference to what they still deem a performance by calling our dear brother Kendrick Lamar some kind of pagan Satanist, when the evidence is contrary, he is a beacon of light, if you're able to accept it. But, you know, the NFL has done far worse atrocities than what you are talking about in your current commentary. I mean, Colin Kaepernick, did you blame the NFL for what they have done to marginalize black voices or women? Abuse victims? No. You only came up with this religious mumbo jumbo when a black man told you the truth and happened to have a smile while doing it. Conservative commentator Matt Walsh described the performance as, quote, easily the worst halftime show we had ever seen. Now, don't they say this every year? Yeah, they do. Disgraced former Congressman Matt Gaetz chimed in. Wow. The halftime show you just watched is clearly the regime's response to Trump's historic gains with black men. Now, his comment was not the highlight of this post. It was actually Mr. Brian Tyler. In response to Matt Gaetz's response to the halftime show, Brian Tyler said, quote, I hear you like them young, end quote. Well played, sir. Well played. Another former representative, George Santos, you know, the prolific criminal. I mean, this cat, wow, was more direct. The Super Bowl halftime show is absolute trash. Now, what do all of these individuals have in common? MAGA. They are not for solutions. They are not able to be critiqued. They do not like light. What is light? Light is information. Light is information to break the shackles. Light is truth. They don't want truth. They want propaganda. Now, see, if Kendrick Lamar would have come out singing proud to be an American, oh, my God, he's the greatest thing since sliced bread, the white kind. Ben Shapiro. Icing on the cake right here. No pun intended, Ben. My halftime show review. Actually, it's a beautiful voice and a beautiful accent. The The only problem is I can't understand a word you're saying. But I just say this. Good luck. Live in peace. I know, dear brother, you see, he's speaking a language that you don't. It's called real-ish. And if you're not versed in real-ish conversations, then the language is foreign to you. But I appreciate you telling the truth. Let's break down the imagery here. Put it up full mass. Kendrick Lamar, coming from the background of gang culture, I do myself understand the polarization that is required to navigate egos, check egos, and sometimes finesse egos to survive. The symbolism many of them missed from Kendrick Lamar's epic Super Bowl halftime show was the reality of our gang divisions in the United States of America. I'm not talking about Crips and Blood. I'm talking about us, the gangsters that are truly terrifying, that create your policies that kill your mama. Those are the gangsters that he's talking about. There's this division, this fluid, chaotic division, but we are all in the same space, but divided. And what are we really divided by? Because the colors don't divide us. See, the colors create a category. What divides us is our response to our experiences, exposures, and environments. You see, as a social scientist as well, I believe truly that a person is made up of those three E's, myself included. You change experiences, exposures, and environments, you all of a sudden change a person's perspective. This is why they're fighting hard to make sure you cannot disrupt their normative and privileged experiences, exposures, and environment. Because if you do that, you thus start transforming the person. Uncle Sam, our brother did a wonderful job. He was supposed to represent the sanitized America. Samuel L. Jackson played this role very well. The America that makes most of the Super Bowl viewers comfortable. That's why he said, quote, too ghetto before Not Like Us started playing. And then he was silenced. He was all part of that interplay. If you are bothered by the halftime show being boring, he was there for you. He was enlightening you to the reality of what you are here for. You are here for entertainment, not information, not truth. And so he was that character in the halftime show that allowed everyone, if they were able to get it, we all understand it, that this is intentional, that this is going to make y'all comfortable. All right. So Jackson's Uncle Sam said that Lamar's performance was, quote, too ghetto, telling him to, quote, tighten up. That was in the beginning. Before flashing back to his dancers taking shape of the American flag. As one user wrote on X, the creativity alone serves as a perfect example as why Kendrick won that Pulitzer in the first place. Now, remember, typically, if there are black people on stage dancing, the writer is concerned about or complaining about body movement, body features, lack of clothing, lack of class, taste, appropriateness. But none of that was a complaint. Boring. That's all they said. Now, the entire performance was obviously steeped in American imagery on an incredibly deep level, from dancers dressed in the colors of the American flag to Jackson narrating Lamar's journey playing the great American game. He then said, quote, I want to perform their favorite song, but, you know, they love to sue, end quote. Naturally, this sent the internet into a frenzy with fans shocked just how frank Lamar was at that moment. And in case you forgot, last month, Drake filed a defamation lawsuit against Universal Music Group, claiming that UMG approved and helped promote the false factual allegation that the headlines rapper was or is a certified, quote, certified pedophile, as Lamar raps in Not Like Us. A truly, truly, a truly difficult moment to digest was this one. Okay. When I saw Serena Williams, not on the sideline, not in the crowd, but on a stage, part of the performance, when Kendrick Lamar finally performed Not Like Us, the camera quickly moved over to Serena, who was seen dancing to the song Williams dated Drake 2 years ago. Now, let me say this, all right? We got to stop this. This may be too much for our brother Drake. I mean, damn it, man. I've been saying for years, and people thought I was hating on Drake. I said, Drake is the number one rapper out of Canada. But when we put him up against the greatest of all times, I said, you're setting him up. You're setting him up. What is he doing now? No offense to my Canadian viewers, but he's acting real Canadian in hip hop right now. And that's cool because he's Canadian. But to have your ex-girlfriend crip walking on a stage when the song is about you liking minors, oh my goodness, man. All right, Waz.
I mean, to get back to the right wingers for a sec, I think if you're Kendrick Lamar in his camp, you woke up very happy this morning knowing that who your greatest critics were the exact right people right. to be pissed off. Like, that goes without saying. These guys don't get it. Just the idea that this was boring, I think, is crazy. The guy obviously put on a performance, well thought out, very brilliantly executed. And the bottom line is the guy had one of the biggest years a rapper's ever had in the history of the genre. And so the idea that he didn't belong on that stage and performing his artistry in a way that he deemed most appropriate is just crazy to me. Like, he earned that moment and he did with it what he's always done in his career. He's always been big on the symbolism and messaging about America and especially places like Compton where he grew up. And, you know, that goes without saying. In terms of the performance and, like, you know, vanquishing his enemies and Drake and others, like, the message was sent. The message was clear. It's definitely a victory lap of proportions that we've never seen. And, yeah, I don't know how you watch that and not think this guy put a lot of time, effort, and talent into what he did. And I thought it was a flawless execution of all of those things. And, you know, if Ben Shapiro doesn't get it, you probably did the right thing with your halftime show performance.
That's right. The problem would be if you agreed with any of those individuals that disagreed with the halftime show, you need to look in the mirror because you're not in good company. All right. And big ups to Kendrick, first rapper to solo an entire halftime show. Big ups to him. He earned it, and he is doing it with a credible message. All right.
Finally, we take a look at what happened in Gaza this week as we look at the events leading up to this past Saturday.
Egypt and Qatar are stepping up efforts to salvage the Gaza ceasefire deal. Mediators are urging Israel and Hamas to commit to the agreement, with reports a high-level Hamas delegation is in Cairo. Israel's prime minister has threatened to resume the war if Hamas does not release more captives on Saturday. We can now speak to H.A. Hellier, who's a senior fellow at the Royal United Services Institute and a specialist in security studies in the Middle East. Joining us from Cairo, welcome back to Al Jazeera. Are you optimistic that Israel and Hamas can reach a compromise before Saturday on this weekend's supposed to be scheduled round of exchange between the Israeli captives and the Palestinian prisoners?
Thank you very much for having me on the program. So the ceasefire outline, which, by the way, is what the Netanyahu government instructed the cabinet to refer to this as. It's an outline, it's a framework, not a deal or agreement, which I think represents the amount of good faith that's gone into this. is, I think, in very serious jeopardy at present. The Israeli government has not shown a tremendous amount of commitment to this outline in the first place. The numbers of Palestinians that have been killed during the ceasefire period already have been in at least several dozen. And of course, you have the lack of an actual mandated Israeli delegation to Doha that has the mandate to actually negotiate about phase two. That still hasn't taken place. People have been sent, but they don't have the mandate to do very much. And then, of course, you have in the background Donald Trump's administration talking about, clearing out Gaza, a Riviera on the Mediterranean. All of that, quite frankly, simply strengthens the Israeli far right and those who really want Netanyahu to just go back to war.
So when you look
and
at...
I'm sure that the...
My apologies, but when you think about this coming Saturday and what may happen, what do you think will happen?
So what I was trying to get at is that there isn't a tremendous amount of good faith in these negotiations in the first place. I think Hamas is very concerned about it breaking down because the scenario for Hamas, if this breaks down, is far worse than if it continues. So it's not because they're a good actor. It's that this doesn't work in terms of their interests. But when it comes to the Israeli side, and of course they're the ones that have the most power in this relationship, they see so many different possibilities opening up as the result of Trump's plans that he's made clear over the past couple of weeks. So it's a very dangerous time. We might see an extension of phase one. We might see more hostages being released or more prisoners being released. But I don't know how much faith we can put into the idea that phase two will take place without tremendous pressure from the Trump administration on the Israelis, which I just don't think is very likely at the present moment.
Look, speaking of Trump's plan, the Reuters news agency is reporting, citing Egyptian security sources, in fact, that the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, reportedly will not travel to Washington for talks at the White House scheduled for some time this month if that agenda includes U.S. President Donald Trump's plan to uproot Palestinians from Gaza. Is this plan setting up the U.S. and Egypt on some sort of collision course?
Well, yes and no, in the sense that neither Egypt nor Jordan will accept the Riviera plan. And they have the full backing of the Arab League in that regard. And I think, frankly, everywhere else in the world, we've seen this narrative coming about where, the Arabs are not in favor of the Riviera plan. Well, actually, the world isn't in favor of the Riviera plan. The UK, the EU, many of the US's own allies internationally have come out very, very strongly against the idea that you can just move Palestinians out and create some sort of Riviera on the Mediterranean there instead. So I think that it does make it clear that, you know, D.C. and Cairo really just don't see eye to eye on this. Having said that, they haven't really seen eye to eye when it comes to the Gaza war and the last 15 months generally. I do think that the Egyptian president will go to D.C. eventually, but I think wants to have a plan. The Jordanian king yesterday said that there are discussions that are undergoing. I think that we'll see coming out of different Arab partners together, which I think the Arab League will endorse,
right,
a plan for reconstruction of Gaza. And then, you know, maybe a visit to D.C.
I did want to ask you what Cairo will propose, but also how long Egypt can hold this off for, because at the end of the day, Egypt is a huge recipient, one of the biggest recipients, in fact, of U.S. foreign aid. And Donald Trump has threatened to possibly withhold foreign aid from the two countries, Jordan and Egypt.
So there are two things here. First of all, in terms of the plan, I think it'll really go in. I have not seen any plan, but my expectation is that it will go into talking about reconstruction, about how to do reconstruction without having Palestinians leave, so temporary residences in Gaza. You know, I think it'll go into that sort of detail and possibly talk about, you know, taking people for medical reasons, like the Jordanian king did yesterday with regards to 2,000 Palestinian children. When it comes to keeping up the pressure and the aid, so one, Trump actually walked back somewhat his threat about aid with regards to Jordan last night. When it comes to Egypt, you're right. Of course, Egypt is the second largest recipient of American aid, second to Israel. It's a far second, of course. But when it comes to that aid, most of it goes right back to the United States in terms of engaging with military contractors. So it would be really, you know, not in the U.S. interest to actually cut that in the first place. And second, when you look at Egypt's overall GDP, we're talking a tiny amount. And it's certainly an amount that could be offset by support from the Gulf. So I don't think the aid is going to be remotely sufficient to get Egypt to say, you know what, yeah, we're going to go for this Riviera plan. I frankly don't see a scenario where either the Jordanians or the Egyptians, for purely very strategic interests, will say, yeah, sure, we'll go for the Riviera plan. I just don't see that scenario being possible.
Okay, we'll leave it there. H.A. Hellyer, Senior Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, speaking to us from Cairo.
WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cacciato, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Well, good morning, everybody. Happy Tuesday if you're listening on Tuesday, and happy Thursday in the future if you're listening on Thursday, or I think it's Friday, actually, now. Weird schedule shifting. Happy good morning. But also happy Constitution Day. Constitution Day is today. What a wonderful way to kind of frame what we're going to be addressing kind of sort of today. Just before we get into the mix of things, as always, everything you hear on the show today is strictly my view and not representative of the station's view on the whole. If I have anyone else soon enough, 9:30 doesn't seem to be very conducive to college students looking to hop on for a nice little conversation. I don't blame them. I haven't even had my coffee yet, but that's a little bit more my fault than anything. But today, is Constitution Day. So what I wanted to do was touch on a couple quick little news tidbits worth noting. And then going on to talk a little bit about, you know, the Constitution. Why do we even want to talk about the Constitution? Is, you know, the Constitution worth talking about? Is the Constitution worth keeping? All this and more on The Angry Young Man today. So, we'll start off just with, you know, for those of you who have been following the show for a while, you'll know I'm, bit of a Milei fanatic, Javier Milei from Argentina, the current president of the country, for running up on about a year in December. What's going on down there? Well, things are turning. The wheels of government are turning, and he's just been doing what politicians tend not to do, and following through on promises and making the hard choices very often. So a quick recap for those of you who are unaware with the situation in Argentina. Argentina has long been in a state of stagnation ever since Juan Perón took power in the 1950s and instituted his kind of third way economic, whatever you want to call it, that involved mass nationalization of different firms in the country, specifically British investment. Basically, it was kind of like a, you know, we're not socialists, but we're not, you know, we're not going to turn away from some of those wonderful goodies that they've been using out there. So what happens? Argentina goes from being like a top-rate world economy, like preeminent power in like the secondary or tertiary league of powers. Like, they were on par with Australia, which isn't, you know, like, wow, they're on par with Australia. But, I mean, it was pretty good. They were doing great, and they were set to grow, but Perón kind of killed that. And they've stagnated since. I've dealt with massive inflation recently as well due to fiscally irresponsible management of government. Between massive spending, price controls, and nationalization of key industries, as well as massive import barriers, the country kind of turned itself upside down, inside out, and kind of screwed everyone over. I mean, I'll be frank. I had my grandmother was born in Argentina, left Argentina in the 1950s with my great-grandparents because of the regime change in Argentina when Perón became president and started instituting these reforms. It spelled trouble for everybody. Everyone was trying to get out if they had the ability to do so. But anyways, what happens in the kind of midst of this crisis arrives this guy, Javier Milei. Now, who is he? This guy was an economist who'd go on talk shows and kind of talk about, you know, why is government and what it's doing right now completely and utterly irresponsible and ineffective and ultimately being the reason that you're going through so much hardship. I mean, he had a very energetic style that kind of caught about him. But what he was doing that a lot of people weren't doing is talking about the economic ideas of Austrian school economists. Now, the Austrian school, started by a guy named, I'm blanking right now, it's early in the morning, blanking on the founder right now, but Karl Menger, there we go, and then kind of developed and made popular by Ludwig von Mises, who's an Austrian economist who then mentored many, many other economists, namely Friedrich Hayek in that mix as well. But why are they important? They offer this perception of economics that kind of centers itself on certain principles, which can be best described as free market in nature. And while, you know, in many cases their ideas have kind of been taken on by either the mainstream or Chicago economists, I mean, Milton Friedman took a lot of cues from Austrian economics, but Milei, as an economist, was, you know, kind of the way that he went about describing himself was as an Austrian, and in terms of his influences. All this to say, though, he brought this radical idea of cutting down the government, you know, reducing the state, reducing expenditure, and putting the kind of passing the buck back to the people of Argentina. And in the midst of triple-digit inflation, and in an election where he was running against the economic minister of that administration, which had caused the inflation, Milei managed to pull out first and became the first libertarian president in world history. Now, what has he been doing? Dramatically cutting down government bureaucracy, tapering back spending, massive austerity, which, you know, one of the things he acknowledged at the outset was the difficulty of, you know, trying to do this without any pain. There was going to be pain eventually in repealing years and years of failed policy in Argentina. And, you know, while there's been some pain, there's been tremendous gain. Inflation almost slowed down to a halt, as well as massive surplus compared to what had been seen in the past. Now, all this to say, tying back to the present, he recently got up in front of their Congress and basically made a declaration of, you know, we're going to cut the deficit with this spending bill, or I'm not going to pass it. I'm going to veto it. Taking a very strong stand on that matter. I mean, I can maybe get a quote here in terms of what he said on the budget, but the, you know, he's not compromising here. I mean, so he basically went up and said, well, you know, I promised a fiscal surplus. If you attempt to threaten this zero deficit plan, I'm going to knock it down, which, listen, I think that takes a lot of sheer confidence and, you know, bravery to be able to stand up there and make those sorts of tough decisions in the interest of fixing your country. Now, how does this all tie back to the kind of grander theme of today? So I actually wrote something not too long ago, put it out on out of my local paper back in New York. But Milei and what he stands for and what he's trying to achieve stands at the very heart of the ideas that founded our nation. Now, what do I mean by that? The United States exists, you know, very, very differently than other countries as a country built on ideas. A country built on the idea that you should have determination over your life, what you do, how you spend your money. You know, these are very core tenets of what America is supposed to be. It's enshrined and woven through our Constitution. Our Constitution is inherently a document which aims to uphold the idea that there ought to be government which is limited, government which works for the people, and government which cannot overly intrude itself on the lives of its citizens. You know, we had a Bill of Rights as well, which, you know, there's the argument to be made that it was redundant because, of course, people wouldn't look at the Constitution and, you know, assume that those, you know, those rights are not a given. They said, you know, how could we expect that, you know, if the Constitution already goes about ensuring that government can't trample on these rights intrinsically, why should we have to spell it out? As we've seen in the last 200 or so years, we really needed to spell it out. It's kind of scary how much we needed to spell it out for numerous reasons. You know, for one, the amount of times that, I mean, you could look back to American legal history and jurisprudence that surrounded Bill of Rights related cases. I mean, it's the amount of times we'd have to lean back on those provisions of the Constitution to ensure that government is not having a field day trampling your rights is tremendous. I mean, to this day, I mean, we have consistent attacks from government on Bill of Rights, you know, enumerated rights, you know. Well, to, you know, kind of even go back for a second, I mean, we, you know, a lot of these people that founded our government said, why should we even have to spell it out? You know, people should be already able to know that looking at this document, the government's granted very specific things that it can do. And among those things that it can't do is restrict your right to free speech, your right to bear arms, your right to, you know, any number of things listed in the Bill of Rights. But there was a push to kind of enumerate them because with very valid concern, the government could very quickly trample those rights. You know, government, even with the Bill of Rights in place, has gone and kind of made a mockery of our Constitution in many ways. It's a very good book I read not too long ago called Who Killed the Constitution? It's a Tom Woods book, and it kind of goes through this long, not really long, but through many case studies in which the federal government has outright just ignored the Constitution. The purpose of why we have the Constitution is to very explicitly limit the scope of government. But what we've seen over the past 200 or so years is that government will find every little nook and cranny in which it can expand its power and do so, you know. The executive will take opportunities to ban speech which is detrimental to the war effort with the Sedition Acts, or it will intern Japanese Americans or Italian Americans or German Americans because they're seen as a national security threat. It will intervene in labor negotiations and, you know, any number of things that constitutionally are completely, totally unthinkable. But just do it anyways, because who's going to stop them? You know, it all kind of ties back to, you know, why the ideas that we have that are central to who we are. In large part, you know, while we have a constitution that is embedded with those ideas of liberty, limited government, self-determination, we very often fail to follow through on those ideas and fail to ensure that the next generation of Americans value those things. You know, we're, like I said earlier, a country that is founded on ideas. We're not, you know, Italy, for example, is founded on the fact that they're Italians. Italians, in their kind of shared history and ethnicity and what have you, are a nation because of that. And that's their identity. Italy exists because there are Italian people. Now, America could exist because there's American people, but then you'd be talking about the hundreds of native nations to the land in which we inhabit. And that's kind of the what you would call the American nations. But if they were based on simply the American people, you know, American people come from a vast range of backgrounds and different nations. But we're not, you know, a nation necessarily of those qualities. We're a nation of the ideas that we as a people jointly uphold. You know, there's some of them which we have fairly broad consensus on, but there's some we don't. And it's okay to disagree, but, you know, you can find sometimes when you disagree with someone who is a very different mind, if you can't find a point at which you overlap, it's very hard to kind of come to some sort of compromise. And that's the problem that's happening in terms of our national identity. We, in many ways, can't agree on some of the basics that were agreed on at the outset. You know, we have people that want to expand the scope of government and ensure freedoms from as opposed to freedoms to. What I mean by that is, you know, the idea that, you know, in the absence of government intervention, you have certain freedoms. But there are those who claim that if government acts in your interest, you gain freedom by, you know, having freedom from hunger, freedom from, you know, what have you. But those freedoms from require pulling back on freedoms too. Freedom to spend your money as you please is not very conducive to freedom from homelessness, if that requires government to have a program for housing, because who's going to pay for it? You are. So all things to consider there in terms of you know, what's going on. I think, you know, and I said this in the aforementioned little article, I think it's important that we look back at the ideas on which we were founded and, you know, kind of look to Argentina and what's going on right now as a reminder of what we claim to hold near and dear to ourselves as a nation, but also as a, you know, at least consolation that even if we fall very far astray of that, there's a way back. There's always a way back. But that way back requires that people are ready and willing to kind of get on the same page, which in some cases has not been the case. But before we get back into that, just wanted to let you know very quickly that Tartan Ink joins you in supporting WRCT. Tartan Ink is a full-service copy print shop conveniently located in the University Cohen Center on Carnegie Mellon University campus. Services provided by the Copy Center include black and white and color copies, single and double-sided copying, assortment of colored and textured papers, including cover stock, specialty papers such as gloss paper, resume quality paper, as well as large format poster paper. They also offer binding and finishing options that include cutting, lamination, folding, padding, stapling, tape binding, thermal binding, collating, comb binding, and coil binding, as well as being an authorized ship and drop site for UPS shipping. For more information, visit their website at cmu.edu /tartaninc or call 412-268-4828. And if you're interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information. Also, did you know that a single ember that escapes from a wildfire can travel over a mile, carrying a world of trouble? It can land, ignite, and destroy your home and community. You can't control where that ember will land, but you can control what happens before it does. With simple steps to adapt to wildfire, like cleaning areas around buildings, knowing community safe zones, and making sure your local fire departments are prepared, you and your neighbors help protect your homes and community from more wildfire damage. Becoming fire-adapted is more than one person can take on alone. It takes a community to protect a home. Visit fireadapted.org today to find more tips and tools to help you protect your home and community from wildfires. Get fire-adapted. Public service message brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and WRCT. Also, just a couple shows we have here on WRCT. Firstly, From Here to Eternity. Everyone thinks they know the 80s hits, but on the other side of the Atlantic lies a treasure trove of synth-drenched sounds that filled the airwaves of Europe back in the day. Take a trip back to the 80s you never knew with DJ Tony Tunes. From Here to Eternity, Mondays at 4 p.m. Also, tune into Kaleidoscope. An eclectic hour of music with your very own DJ Kate, Mondays at 10, only on WRCT Pittsburgh. Add to the colorful mix by calling in requests. Alrighty. Well. So, I say all this to kind of set the tone going into the election as well. You know, we often find that a lot of the discourse that we have today isn't very constitutionally grounded. We're not really kind of taking heed to where the Constitution comes into play. And that's a double-sided issue. I think that both sides of the coin are guilty of that. I think in many cases, the expansion of the power of the presidency that both would seek to undertake would not be conducive to the sort of national identity we've laid out for ourselves. I'd like to think that if any of the people responsible for putting the Constitution together, which is kind of just James Madison, which props to James Madison for putting together the Constitution pretty much by himself. That man practically locked himself in a room for about a year or two, studied pretty much every form of government, came back to the Constitutional Convention and was like, here's the government, have fun. So, if you ever have any qualms with the government, direct it towards James Madison, because very likely he wrote the part that you didn't like. But this all to say, it's concerning how little regard for the Constitution there is in kind of broader discourse surrounding. At least in the presidential context, you know, it's not really touched on much outside of kind of like a passing reference to the values of our nation. And then briefly, you know, afterwards swept aside and, you know, moving on to talking points. You know, we especially you hear the you know, a big talking point at the Democratic National Convention was this idea of, like, you know, they use the word freedom a lot. But I don't know if any of you have ever watched The Princess Bride, but it's that, you know, there's the one scene where he's like, that word, use it a lot, but I don't think you know what it means. I don't think they know what it means when they use it in the context they do. There's, you know, a lot of lip service to freedom, but not so much action on freedom when you're, you know, willing to engage in other unconstitutional things like, you know, shutting down the country and penalizing people for exercising freedom of movement. Who would have thought? Yeah, it's also somewhat concerning how short the national memory can be. But, you know, words of encouragement as we, you know, head into these next, you know, couple of weeks, little under 2 months left before the election. Read the Constitution if you can. It's not too long. There's a couple amendments at the end, but it's not too long. It'll give you a good idea of, you know, what do we value? Why are we here? How do we work? And what should we strive to be? We often kind of lose that because I don't think people take enough time to go back and look at the Constitution. You know, the Constitution, outside of being our governing document, is, again, kind of the, you know, the why. Why are we doing this? Why do we have a country? And that's an important thing to remember, because if you forget who we are, if you lose that in the mix of, you know, your partisan agenda to achieve whatever have you, if you're a cult of personality or you're looking to dramatically increase the size of the federal government or, you know, what have you, you need to be grounded in why we're here and how do we work. And it's worth everyone taking a little bit of time to, at least, you know, on this Constitution Day, take some time, read a Constitution. I'm going to be practicing what I preach. I'm going to be giving a little gander myself as well as handing out constitutions because, you know, you should read it. It's as Americans, you should know why this country you live in is here. What is it here for? What does it mean? Why did so many people risk their lives to protect this idea or to leave their countries and come to this beacon of idealism? You know, what makes America, what's that special sauce that makes America different from everyone else? And that's the Constitution. So take that time if you can. Give it a little read. Find areas you might disagree. Think, why do I disagree? You know, do I really believe in the mission we have as a nation? You got to believe in the mission we have as a nation. You know, it's to have a nation which is divided in its goal for itself is a nation without vision. And the founders laid out a national vision for us. You know, Benjamin Franklin was asked, you know, towards the end of putting together the Constitution, you know, what form of government are we going to have? And he said, a republic, if you can keep it. At the same time, Tocqueville observed American democracy and wrote about it and spoke to his concern about the eventual kind of delegation of liberties and freedoms to the state until we've given it all away for safety. And that's the tendency that people have right now, to not value the liberty we have and to rather trade it for safety, to give away the republic that we've been entrusted to keep. So take that time. See where you stand. Take a little temperature check. Read the Constitution. Because now more than ever, it's important that we have a firm grasp on why we're here, what we're doing, and who's going to lead that charge to help us keep the republic. it's worth thinking about. But anyways, I won't hold you much longer. You got things to go do. You got a beautiful rest of your day ahead of you. And with that, I wish you a wonderful, spectacular rest of your day. Hope to see you all next week. Ciao.
I need to pay bills. When is my tax refund coming?
I need to pay my taxes. What are my payment options?
I need to set up a payment plan. How do I do that?
I need answers to my tax questions. Where can I find them?
I need help with my taxes. Does the IRS offer free help?
I need a tax preparer. How should I choose one?
Need answers to your tax questions? Go to irs.gov.
WRCT Pittsburgh is a mistress, a wife, a pen friend, a checkout girl, a complimentary moist lemon-scented cleansing square, or a handy freshen-up wipette. WRCT is the breath of God, the dew on a fresh apple. It's the soft rain of dust that falls into a shaft of morning sun when you pull from an old bookshelf a forgotten volume of romantic diaries. It's a half-remembered childhood birthday party, a creak on the stair, a sputtering match held to a frosted pane, the warm, wet, trusting touch of a leaking nappy, the hulk of a charred panzer, the underside of a granite boulder, the first downy growth on the upper lip of a Mediterranean girl, cobwebs long since overrun by an old Wellington boot.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with a constitutional law scholar on how Trump's executive orders are faring in the courts. Our guest, Steve Rohde, a co-host here on Law and Disorder, includes in his report the first of those executive orders to be decided just a few days ago by the U.S. Supreme Court.
We also dive into the recent presidential threats to cut funding to U.S. colleges that permit so-called illegal protests on campus, exploring the implications for free speech and higher education.
Attorney Mara Verheiden Hilliard of the D.C.-based Partnership for Civil Justice Fund and the Center for Protest Law and Litigation will demystify the constitutionality of Donald Trump's recent threats.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
The number of active lawsuits in federal courts challenging Trump administration arguments has now topped 100. In 21 of those cases, judges have already issued temporary restraining orders or preliminary injunctions, effectively stopping, at least for now, parts of Trump's agenda. For example, as reported in the New York Times this past Sunday, trial court judges have blocked by now Trump's mass firings of civil servants, Musk's access to sensitive federal data, the relocation of transgendered women inmates to men's prisons, the pursuit of immigrants inside houses of worship, and the freezing of up to $3 trillion of federal funding to the states. And in a very important case, a federal judge entered a final judgment reinstating the head of the federal watchdog agency. And just yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled against the Trump administration, halting the sending of those billions of foreign aid dollars. But it must be pointed out that in a number of preliminary victories against Trump's actions, the government, though losing the first round in the cases, have nevertheless stalled in obeying the court's orders. And Trump himself posted the absolutist notion that, and I quote, "he who saves his country does not violate any law," close quote. Five of the judges who have ruled against Trump were appointed by Republican presidents, one by Trump himself. As a result of Trump's losing record in court cases so far, there is now talk on the right of seeking to impeach judges who rule against the Trump administration. And the number of death threats judges are experiencing from the public have gone up alarmingly as well. So today on Law & Disorder Radio, we examine the more important court cases challenging the attempts of the Trump administration to deconstruct the United States both legally and politically. And our guest is one of our co-hosts here on Law & Disorder, Mr. Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a civil rights activist, author, and constitutional scholar. He practiced civil rights law for almost 50 years. He currently serves as chair of the Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace. He is also past president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and the past chair of Death Penalty Focus, as well as the group Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. But today, Mr. Rohde is speaking only for himself. So, Steve Rohde, a warm welcome to Law & Disorder as our guest today.
Jim, thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
First off, Steve, what can you tell us about the